Hello and welcome back to another episode of And the Winner Is, where I am your host, P-Dubs. We will be looking at the Best Picture winner, as we always do, our random choices. And this time it's 2019 winner, Green Book. And joining me, as always, is Tony.
Hello.
I'm slipping over my words tonight. I've had a stonker of a migraine today. It started, and that's why I can't talk properly. It started with one of those ice pick headaches where it feels like someone's jabbing you in the side of your head. Yeah, and we went out this morning. We went out for a walk this morning, and I couldn't get very far. I had to stop. The headache got worse during the day, and then eventually this afternoon it calmed down. I had a bit of a snooze and it got better, but I'm tripping over my words. So as I said, we are here to talk the 2019 winner, Green Book, starring Viggo Mortensen and Maharaja Ali. You can tell I've said that name so many times now because we've talked about him on Marvel things and all sorts of things. So Andy's already been on this show, I think, as well, hasn't he? I've got that name in my head now. It won in 2019. It was a 2018 release. It had a budget of $23 million. Do you want to take a stab at how much it took in the end?
Oh, 185.
It took 85 in the States. It took 321.7 worldwide.
No, that's not a bad return, actually. Yeah.
No, so it did all right. It had an opening weekend in the US of 320,000, so it was obviously a kind of preview thing.
Limited release.
Yeah, to start with. And I was surprised that it was... we've talked about DreamWorks before because they've kind of disappeared from the live action... arena now, but this took Best Picture. It was a DreamWorks film.
They missed that one or two because Private Ryan was one of theirs, which missed that one Best Picture, of course, but got Best Director for Spielberg.
Yeah. It actually didn't get released here until the January, and it took the award in the February. So it was a late release here. As I said, Maharaja Ali, and who obviously is an Oscar winner himself, and Viggo Mortensen, who we've also talked about on this show before, obviously, talking Lord of the Rings. So as always, I'll do a little bit of trivia, as this is a real life story. It actually wasn't based on a book, but was a real life story. It was done from interviews with the characters, the real people.
I'm skipping to the end a little bit, just a footnote. You may cover this, but they both died within in days of each other in 2013, apparently.
Did they? Wow.
Yeah. Or 12 weeks of each other, something. Yeah, around the same time in 2013.
Yeah. Amazing. Said upon the film's release, the Shirley family stated that Tony and Doc were not friends. They had an employer-employee relationship. And he said it in an interview January 2019, audio recordings of an interview with Don Shirley emerged in which he stated, "I trusted him implicitly. You see, not only was Tony my driver, we never had an employer-employee relationship. You don't have time for that bullshit. Mm. My life is in this man's hands, so you've got to be friendly with one another." So his family actually were talking rubbish. He'd admitted that they were friends. The pizza scene is drawn from real life. Nick Vallelonga said Tony Lip used to order a whole unsliced pizza pie, fold it and eat it.
Wow.
And then once Viggo had heard that, he insisted that they try it in the film, and they did. Peter Farrelly, the director, didn't want to. Apparently when they did it, on set, he agreed to film it and didn't really want to put it in, but then the whole crew burst out laughing when he did it. So eventually he agreed to keep it in. Vigo was invited to meet Nick Vallelonga's family over a 6-hour dinner. He said, it almost destroyed me because I hadn't gained the weight yet. I hadn't expanded my stomach. It was almost lethal.
He had put on quite a bit of weight, didn't he? It was quite a shock to see him, actually. He was something quite schlubby.
Yeah, considering what he looked like in Lord of the Rings. And it comes up in my nose. But it's really sad that he doesn't appear more on screen than he does. He did take a back seat after the Lord of the Rings.
It popped up. He did a Cronenberg film a few years back. Quite good. And he's History of Violence or something like that.
And he did the horse film, didn't they? Not long after Lord of the Rings. I can't either. The real Tony Lip is best known for playing Carmine Lupertazzi on The Sopranos. And had a couple of roles in Martin Scorsese movies. According to Peter Farrelly, Viggo Mortensen was surprisingly insecure playing an Italian American, despite being controversial, conversational in Italian. Mortensen insisted on gaining the weight to better get in character, even though Farrelly told him it was unnecessary since Mortensen looked nothing like the real Tony Lip anyway. The title and the subject matter are a reference to the Negro Motorist Green Book, which is seen in the film. Viggo's character Tony uses that book to kind of try and learn about what he's getting into. Maharashtra Ali apologized to Shirley's nephew, Edwin Shirley III, saying that I did the best I could with the material I had, and that he was not aware that there were close relatives with whom I could have consulted to add some nuance to the character. Peter Farrelly had said that he was under the impression there weren't a lot of family members still alive. Quincy Jones was also at a screening, and he told the crowd he'd had the pleasure of being acquainted with Don Shirley while he was working as an arranger in New York in the 1950s. And he was without doubt, without question, one of America's greatest pianists. And interestingly, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, this is interesting to me, as I'm a Lakers fan, and Kareem is obviously a big name in Lakers land. But for those that don't know him for his basketball, he was in Airplane. Very, very, very tall man. He's about 7 foot tall. He's in his 70s now, and he's still, even though he's got a bit of a hunch, he's still massive. He wrote a piece for the Hollywood Reporter regarding discrepancies in the film. He said basically it's things that the family that were in it or weren't in it kind of didn't detract from the film. They were more mundane facts that would have caused the film not to be as good. Apparently Viggo Mortensen revealed that Louis Venner, who was one of Nick's real relatives, caused continuity problems with the family dinner scenes. He kept eating the food after the director had yelled cut, saying, "What props? This is good fish. Come on." So it's really interesting. I'm not going to go into it, but apparently the last little fact, which kind of ties into one we already did, Viggo Mortensen would play Tony Lip's The Soprano episodes in the background while getting ready in the morning to get into his rhythms of speech and accent, which was interesting. So let's dive into the film. As I said, my first note is about seeing Viggo on screen more. I know a lot of people kind of wished he'd been nominated as Best Actor for Aragorn, and obviously didn't. But then, as we know, things like Lord of the Rings, it took them to the third film to give them any awards, let alone acting ones. At that point, it wasn't the dumb thing to give someone an Oscar from fantasy or science fiction or anything like that. So he never got that. But yeah, I'd just like to see him a bit more on screen. And obviously he's getting on a bit now. I think he's in his 60s now. Because he was obviously the for those that don't know, he wasn't the original choice for Aragorn. He was brought in after filming started because they cast Stuart Townsend before realizing he was too young to play the role. And they brought Viggo in as a as an older actor, even then. And that was 20 odd years ago. So he's got to be in his 50s, 60s now. So I don't think much is going to change in terms of him getting more screen time. I think he's probably even more set in his ways now than he was 20 years ago. I'll be honest, I didn't know much about this film. And it certainly wasn't what I was expecting.
And it's one that I didn't get to see at the time. Because I was just having a look, I just remembered what we didn't mention what it was up against for Best Picture. And it was the year of Black Panther.
Yes.
So there was Black Panther, Black Klansman, Bohemian Rhapsody, The Favourite, Roma, which I watched recently, funnily enough, Star is Born and Vice.
Yeah, so it certainly wouldn't have been the one you would pick.
No.
Out of that list, there's at least three that you would say there that would have been in front of it.
Yeah, well, I've actually seen quite a chunk of these. I've seen Panther, of course, and Black Klansman, Bo Rap. And I watched Roma recently, and I've seen Vice. And
yeah.
The only ones I hadn't seen, still, are A Star is Born and The Favourite.
Yeah, I've seen The Star is Born. I think I've watched it twice. We've got it on DVD somewhere in the house, but it's never been watched. I think if I remember rightly, I think I watched it on a plane to Orlando.
Yeah.
If I remember rightly.
So like I was saying, in terms of the more coming out in that sort of early in the year, that sort of January, February, March, it's the one that kind of passed me by a little bit at the time.
Yeah, definitely. Then I didn't realise Linda Cardellini was in it.
I didn't know. That was a nice surprise. I'd written that down.
She kind of bookends the film as well, doesn't she, quite nicely? I quite like that.
Again, she's an actress that you'd like to see more of.
Yeah, and she's another one that kind of had that period with Scooby-Doo, didn't she?
Yeah.
Where she was on screen quite a lot for a while in the late 90s, early 2000s with that.
Yeah.
And then didn't really make a reappearance until...
Marvel?
Yeah. And alongside this, would have been around the same time. But again, it was another one. She's not in Hawkeye enough. But no. that was down to COVID. Obviously, she didn't want to travel with a family. So she filmed all her stuff out in the farm. Whereas the rest of the family ended up in New York. So yeah, that was a shame, but it was really nice to see her pop up. The opening sets up a lot of really weird circumstances that kind of bring everything together, which I quite like.
Yeah, there's quite a bit thrown in there. I mean, we have that sort of that fight early on in the club where we see him throwing his way around as a bouncer.
Yeah.
There is that nice aesthetic as well, that 60s aesthetic at the start of the film. Put me in mind of other stuff, a bit like Goodfellas and things like that.
Yeah, definitely that Italian New York vibe, isn't it? Which is great. And I just love how it all comes together.
Yeah. It's interesting, it's something we don't talk about much is the aesthetic. And particularly, there's a couple of scenes with this where there's some nice street scenes with cars and stuff. Just as an aside, always blows my mind in these period pieces where I can do all those street stuff. And there's always vehicles as far back as you can see on screen.
Yeah.
And you think, how the hell do they manage to keep that so tight when you're like half a mile down the road, there's still like 60s cars.
Yeah. just all of that, like the club that, as you mentioned, where the fight happens, is so 60s. And then obviously their apartment.
Is
incredibly 60s. But to think that was 50, what, 60 years further on, nearly. to be able to replicate that and for it to really look like it as well. And it's something we don't talk about enough.
Well, we don't talk about the design on these films much at all, really.
Yeah, and half the time we don't need to because that's not what it's about. But I think that's kind of what this film is about.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's it's a lot of we've talked about how some of the earlier films are kind of little vignettes. This isn't. This is kind of one story told in little sections because of the fact it does become a bloody travel movie.
It's a road movie at the end of the day.
Yeah.
With these sort of dark and potentially grim interludes at certain points across their travels.
Yeah, and I think that's another reason why we can talk kind of the design and how this film is kind of put together, because it isn't all one place. We get that New York vibe at the start and at the end, but then we see a lot more of America throughout, and the change in scenery and stuff like that, and the change in vibe of where they are. The other thing I wanted to bring up...
starts off... Go on.
No, I was just going to say, I wanted to bring up the costumes as well.
Yeah.
Because obviously we've got his... Like, Italian...
Really dapper, and he's working those suits, I have to say.
So we've got that authentic Italian New York kind of look to start with. The bowling shirts and stuff like that. And then we get him, obviously, he wears suits later on. And Maharaja's costumes as well.
Yeah, so he's rocking those outfits.
Yeah, and then you've got that first outfit when we meet him, when he's in his apartment.
The robes thing.
And that whole design of where he lives as well is just... still feels 60s.
The Carnegie Hall pop up in it as well.
Yeah. Yeah. The fact that he lived above it. Blows your mind, doesn't it? And the fact that it's real, that he did actually live there, is just brilliant. We do get a couple of cameos from kind of TV. We get Iqbal Thiba from Glee. He played the principal in Glee. For anybody who also doesn't know, he's Joey's doctor on Friends when he has his kidney stones taken out. That's the one we always talk about, because whenever we see him, we just go, kidney stones, because he's brilliant. And we also get Bob. Bob from That 70s Show as well. You would have seen him. I can't remember his real name, but he was in Stargate a couple of times as well.
I can't
even think of it. No, I can't either. I've got the thing open, so it should appear. Let's have a look and see where he is on the cast list, because he's not in it for very long, but he is quite a well-known actor. Let me see if I can find it. As soon as Don Stark. So that's great. Let's talk about the two leads as well. Maharaja Ali has such a screen presence. Everything he's in, he owns the screen. He did it.
Yeah.
He did it in Luke Cage. Every time he was on screen, he filled the screen. Which is strange now, because
that show never quite recovered after they.
No, it didn't. And then that was obviously after he took that role, I think, before he got his Oscar, and then he won it before the show started filming. He pretty much went, look, I agreed to this before I became what I am. I'm only going to be around for like half the season and then I'll be gone. He never did recover. He was by far the best villain that they had. But now it's strange because he's going to be in the MCU again.
That's Blade.
Yeah,
hopefully it will happen.
Apparently he should be filming within the next 6 months. So,
and it would be interesting to see what he brings to that role.
Yeah,
with the stature that he has. And
yeah, He just fills the screen.
Yes, yeah.
And kind of that's what Blade needs, because he doesn't say a lot. He needs that presence. He definitely has it.
A lot of heavy lifting to do. He's in the sort of the superior role in the film as well, in terms of he's the boss of the two of them, and steers their relationship effectively.
Yeah.
But also is sort of required to play some real sadder elements. Like the bit where Tony has to go and get him, and he's sort of handcuffed naked in the bloody the shower room. And I'd never thought at that point that was maybe another reason why his marriage had broken down, because the guy was gay or bi.
Yeah. Definitely. It's really interesting
in that respect.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It took me by surprise, as you say. It wasn't something I'd thought of.
Because it's not even really hinted at any point in the film.
No, and the fact that he talked about being married and everything, it was a very out of the blue kind of thing, like where he kind of explained that his marriage had broken down because he was working and things like that. And it certainly wasn't what I was expecting, and the fact that you put him in that himself in that position as well, when he'd already had trouble
in the bar earlier in the film.
And then Vigo. We have to talk about Vigo as well. He's such a chameleon. Such different characters. Because you see him as this leading action man from Lord of the Rings. And then this is the complete opposite.
Yeah.
Like, he really doesn't want to be doing anything. He'd much rather be sitting on his bum eating hot dogs. completely opposite.
And a guy who at the start of the film has got prejudices of his own, we see. The bit with the glasses, when the two the engineers came to fix the war or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And he puts his glasses on, so he's having to play that as well at the start of the film. This bloke, we've got some prejudices within him, compared to his wife, interestingly.
Yeah, who's very, I think she's very open hearted.
Yeah.
In that sense, the fact that she kind of accepts anybody.
Yeah.
Like even people that are doing the wrong thing. Throughout it, she knows, and she kind of accepts as well that he has to go and do this and be away from them for however long. It's 3 months, isn't it? I think
something like that, I think.
Just really warm-hearted, which I love, and the chemistry between them as well. I love the whole him writing her a letter,
and
that he learns.
And the fact that she kind of knew anyway that he was acting with them.
And the fact that there was always that kiss the kids at the end. Just a lovely relationship, considering they're not on screen together that much.
No.
Well,
I like, because I did write that he was a real... That Dom was quite a tight arse at the start of the film, wasn't he? He's really sort of just wanting to loosen up a bit. Through Tony, he does sort of loosen up eventually.
Yeah, he does, and that's the thing. And kind of that final scene when he kind of throws a hissy fit after all that time, when he's kind of stood up and just gone, "I'll take whatever comes," and just get on with it. And then that final gig, when they're at the club and they refuse to serve him food.
Yes, yeah.
And the turn in the middle of that. Because he kind of says, "Oh, I'll just accept it. I'll just get on with it." And then it kind of gets halfway through the conversation and he's like, "No, I shouldn't be accepting that. Yeah, I'm just going to go."
Yeah. Because first of all, he says, "I won't play unless you let me in here and eat." And then he's right, "That's it. I'm out of here."
Yeah,
and then Tony basically just whisks him away, doesn't he? And he sort of,
and then the final scenes in the bar.
Yeah, then they get that the orange bar, orange whatever it's called. It's just when you see him finally loosen up.
Yeah,
it's quite a nice moment.
Yeah, And that, talking of Tony as well, it's quite interesting because he doesn't want to play by the rules, but if someone else doesn't play by the rules, he doesn't like it.
No, no. He does think with his fists once or twice, doesn't he?
Yeah.
The one with the copper in the rain was a sort of... But of course, Don calls him out on that as to whether it was really all about Don or not, whether it was just him being pissed off at being called names himself.
Yeah.
But kind of the point of it, at the start of the film, the things he does are really for himself. But eventually it is for Don.
Yeah, very much so. And at this point, I kind of noted down, this is very much like a kind of a modern take on Driving Miss Daisy.
Yeah, funnily enough, it, in terms of its reception, it's another one of these films which has sort of been reevaluated already, and even at the time, because it was sort of not everybody in the community thought it was worthy winning, because it's one of these white savior movies,
yeah,
as they call it. Where it's very much about, it's because it's directed by a white guy as well, and it's very much from the view of the white man sort of saving the day. And the only counter to that would be is that the fact that if it was not based on a real situation, I could get that would have a bit more weight, do you think?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. But the fact it is
there
real.
There was a white guy that did work for him and became his friend. It makes that slightly different, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's you can't take away from it because of that fact, because it did happen.
Because whereas in Driving Miss Daisy, there was a little bit more of that element of the white savior bit in terms of her, really.
Yeah.
And the way that she stood up for him, for Hope. Yeah, that was just my thought on the white savior element.
Yeah, definitely. And it does have similarities. Obviously, it's switched round this time. But on that note, I think this does a really great job of kind of showing how big that difference is between classes and.
Yes.
And races and things, but it also does a great job of showing how small that gap is as well.
Yeah.
Obviously, we see the outside; it's very, very much there is a separation, but then the relationship between Tony and Don shows just how small it can be.
Yeah, and how easy it should be for people with different backgrounds to come together and be friends.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, isn't always that case.
Yeah, and as we said, there is a couple of turns where Don doesn't help himself.
No.
In that situation.
Has to rely on a Kennedy brother at one point.
Yeah, that's... And that's Tony that's caused that, because he's punched the policeman.
I did smile though when we find out that who Don had called. I thought he'd gone straight to the president, but of course it was Bobby.
Yeah.
And it's just the disgruntled look on the police chief's face, on the sheriff's face when his governor's telling him he's got to let him go.
Yeah.
Brilliant scene.
Yeah, brilliant. And the fact that he's still going.
Yeah.
Saying, no, why are we letting him go? And then he goes, just let him go. Get rid of him now.
Yeah.
It's just brilliant. Yeah, I really like that. At this point, I want to say, and we've already talked about the actors themselves, but I always think that a film's only as good as the chemistry between its leads.
Yeah.
If there's no chemistry, then the film is never going to work. And these two are brilliant together. They just bounce off each other, depending on what situation they're in. I was surprised at how much comedy there was at times throughout this film as well. You don't see Viggo kind of as a comedic actor, but he has some really funny moments in this.
Little moments like the train getting to eat the fried chicken in the back of the car and stuff like that.
You've got that. And I love the fact that it starts with the joke about Pittsburgh and the fact that they bring it back. Titsburg.
Yeah.
The fact that he goes, I've got something to tell you. I didn't think that what they told us was right. They just had normal-sized breasts. It's just great when you think he's going to come out with something profound.
Yes.
And he comes out with that. It's just, and the timing is just brilliant, which I love. And also the moments towards the end, when Tony pulls out the gun after he pretended earlier on in the film, and you thought, oh, he's just messing around. He's got no gun. And then they come out of the bar, and he has got one.
Yeah.
And he's had it all along.
And I knew you.
Yeah, which is brilliant.
There was one little bit that did amuse me. Was it right in that last sequence where Don drops him back off, and the cinema over the road, he's playing Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah,
I did spot that. Yeah. It did make me chuckle.
Yeah, I like that. And yeah, there was just some really nice moments towards the end of the film. Obviously, the journey of them coming home in the snow.
Yeah.
And Don wanting to get him home.
Yeah.
No matter what.
Yeah, driving the car at the end.
Yeah. Which I thought was great. And the cop as well, that you completely think the same thing's going to happen again.
Yes. Yeah. And it was all about the tire. Yeah. That
was nice. And that he wanted to help them get home.
Mm.
I thought was really nice. And then who would have thought it would end up being a Christmas film?
Yes.
At the end.
I did see the last bit coming though, where you'd appear at the door.
That was obvious.
Yeah, it was just set up in the previous sequence where Don just sat there lonely in his apartment. But of course, they did play a double bluff on it, because of course the knock at the door isn't from him.
Yeah, and it's the guy that you sold the stuff to.
They invited him along.
Yeah. Which I loved, and I thought the chemistry in those final scenes were really good as well between everybody.
Yes, yeah.
Worked really well. But that's kind of the notes I had. Was there anything else that you wanted to add before we wrap up with our final thoughts and score?
No, I thought, like yourself, it was funnier in places than I was expecting. Given the potential subject matter.
Yeah.
I thought it kind of tried too hard, but it worked for it, that in terms of trying to be an Oscar winner. You get that, as I'd written down, an Oscar scene in the rain and every one of these films tends to have one of those moments, and it seems to be in the rain as well. As much as I liked it, I out of that list that we've had, there are other films I think I would have picked for Best Picture over it. Vice, I think, is a very good film, and Christian Bale is fantastic in that, by the way. Recommended. And Roma as well is a really well put together piece, as a drama. For what it is, I enjoyed it for what it is. As I say, I don't know whether I'd have given it the Best Picture, but it was a passable couple of hours. And I think it deals with the subject in a more interesting way than maybe Driving Miss Daisy.
Yeah.
Which I think we felt was a little bit of a dry film, wasn't it, really?
Yeah, it was. It was very straight.
Mm. Yeah. Where this sort of tries to sort of explore both the darkness of the South, and also sort of some of the humour from their burgeoning friendship in that respect. And score-wise, I would probably... Because for me, it's not perfect film, I probably would have to tap out at maybe 79% for this.
Right.
It's almost an 80, but not quite.
Yeah. And I totally get where you're coming from. And I'm different. I probably agree that it probably isn't an Oscar winner in terms of what you'd expect. Doesn't mean I don't think it's a good film in any way, shape, or form. No. My final remarks were, what a beautiful film. While it had a serious point, there is such a warmth to the script and the performances. And that I can't wait to see Ali as Blade, and just that I want to see Viggo on screen more. I actually gave it a 91. Because I thoroughly enjoyed it. But I totally understand where you're coming from and saying it's not your typical Oscar winner in terms of its how it's portrayed. It's very much not the typical serious film that you expect to win. Doesn't mean I don't think it's a really good film.
Well, of course, I mean, that Farrelly's background, of course, is in comedy as well.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, obviously, it's very much so. And yeah, totally agree that I probably would have gone with A Star Is Born, if I'm honest, because I thought that was a hard-hitting film while also taking in the musical aspect that the Oscars love. But yeah, I can totally see where you're coming from. In terms of the fact that it probably wasn't the obvious winner out of that list.
There's kind of a feeling of sort of Hollywood slapping itself on the back a little bit for giving it the award. We've had one or two of these, I think, as well. Moonlight is another one. Crash was another one, I think. But they kind of like to slap themselves on the back for giving them these best pictures.
Yeah.
Where narratively they may not be the strongest film narratively in that year's selection.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm not saying it's got the best content of a film. I just thought it was a really nice film.
Whether you enjoyed it or whether you got from it at the end of the day.
So that wraps our thought on 2019 winner Green Book. For the next episode, as always, I will be handing you over to Tony's capable hands, where we will be looking at the 1931 winner, All Quiet on the Western Front. It's been a long time coming, that one. I think we've been waiting for that to come up for quite a while, back to the early days.
I'm on the back of the remake coming out a year or two back.
Yeah, exactly. So thank you very much for listening. Thank you, Tony, for joining me, as always. And we will see you on another episode of And the Winner Is.